I'm going to talk to you today about Anna Komnene, who's very famous for a Byzantine person, which doesn't really say that much. Anna Komnene was born at the end of the 11th century and lived into the middle of the 12th century. She was the son of the emperor and spent her whole life in Constantinople. And just to give you a little bit of orientation to where we're going to be spending our time today, when her father took over the empire, it was being conquered in the east by Seljuk Turks, right? And so she lived the time when they were being both invaded by Normans and other peoples on the western part of the empire, and the east was being invaded as well. Her father was a very good general, and over the course of his career was able to establish very strong power in the Balkans and to reconquer not all of Anatolia by any means, but those nice parts of it where you can actually grow wine and olives and have Mediterranean economy. So while you look at the map and you think he really lost a lot of territory he was not able to recover, he got all the parts he really thought were the good bits, right, with the help of the Crusaders. So he then was able to pass on stable power to his son, pictured here with his wife, Irene, the Princess of Hungary, and they ruled stably and expanded Byzantine control over those Mediterranean areas in Anatolia throughout his career, and he in turn passed on power to his son Manuel. So it's the history of this, her father, Alexius, that is the subject of our talk today. Anna Komnene wrote a history of her dad, and this is probably the most commonly read Byzantine history source. It's been put into English, it's in Penguin paperback. If you're going to put in any kind of Byzantine text into a history class or any other kind of class, it's going to be this one. And part of the interest is that she describes the passage of the First Crusade. And that's an interest, a topic of interest to a lot of people. And she's always presented as being the Byzantine view on the Crusades, as if her viewpoint is sort of the paradigmatic standard culture representative of her culture. I would dispute that. I think she's actually got some very strange ideas for her culture. But that's one of the reasons why she is so commonly read. Now, her history is very clearly a history within the genre of classical Greek history writing. Right? That genre started by Thucydides and Herodotus and Xenophon. And they established traditions of the way that you ought to write history that were sort of copied and continued throughout the classical period, throughout the Roman Empire and the late antiquity, and then clear through the Middle Ages through to the 15th century. People would write histories using the same sorts of styles and conventions that showed that they were taking part in this genre of writing about history, politics. And Anna's doing that. Her book is definitely part of that tradition, but it also has some strange bits, right? It's weird in some places in that she occasionally bursts out crying or has other big emotional fits. She does other things that are very uncharacteristic and very striking and unusual for a history. And so a lot of people, even if you haven't studied the canon of classical Greek histories and classicizing Greek histories, you still recognize these as aberrant because we've just absorbed enough of this tradition to think that's the way that history is written. So a lot of people perceive her history as kind of full of mistakes or strange things. She's also, this is the only history written in Greek by a woman before the 20th century. Right, there might be some in the 19th century, but I haven't found her. So it's the only Greek history written by a woman. And so whenever someone thinks about these oddities or strange things in the history, they think, oh, it's because she's a girl, right? But it doesn't really go much beyond that. And whenever her gender has been invoked, it allows whatever that particular historian thinks a female historical voice would be to influence their characterization of her work. So for Edward Gibbon, it explained her bad style. He said, instead of the simplicity of style and narrative which wins our belief, an elaborate affectation of rhetoric and science betrays on every page the vanity of the female author. Right? And Charles Deal, who's writing in 1906 of Alexia, said, we must not forget that she was a woman, and consequently had a liking for the decorative, for exterior magnificence, which sometimes concealed from her the true heart of things. and that she was a passionate woman, consumed by hatreds and resentments. And lastly, a learned woman, a literary stylist in love with fine phrases. All this, although it may diminish the strictly historical value of Anna Komnene's work, does not make it by any means less interesting. That's Charles Deal. But then for the feminist historian Barbara Hill and a couple of others working in the late 70s and 80s, her gender justified reading Anna's history as a call for female empowerment. It was kind of hard to do with her text, but yeah, that's what it was for them. Women should have power. Then for James Howard Johnson, writing in 1996, right, her natural female interests and capabilities meant that she must have gotten her military material from someone else. Right. He thought her battle scenes were really good, and a lot of people have said this. She does writes a really great battle, right? So her battle scenes are really good and really convincing, and therefore, says Howard Johnson, they must have been written by a man who is in battle, right? Rather than by a historian who read Thucydides, right? And therefore knew how to make a battle scene look good. But in any case, so he says that she found her husband's notes and that he had written all the military material, and she just kind of knit it together with her own little fancy phrases, but that the real author was her husband. Because how else could a lady write that stuff, okay? So that's basically where the field is in terms of thinking about her gender. But there's another complicating factor in understanding her history, and that is that scholars have developed very clear ideas about what kind of a woman she was. Right, and Deal's passionate woman consumed by hatreds and resentments is pretty typical. Right, so where does this conception come from? And medieval texts, we often interpret them in light of what we think we know about the character of the author, but we get a lot of information about what we know about the character of the author from the medieval texts. Right, so you can see this can easily be circular. And specifically, remember I said she bursts out into emotional fits of tears and things? She presents in herself in her history as deeply mourning and deeply miserable, and this tragic posture has prompted scholars to look for explanations of what went wrong in her life. Yet there's nothing particular in what we know about her life that would spark such extravagant expressions of misery. So Georgina Bruckler, who is an English historian working in the 1920s, she had a whole subchapter in her book on Anna called The Author's Self-Pity, in which she tries to go through all the things in her life and figure out what could have possibly made her so melancholic. And she says she can't find anything that would warrant those sentiments. And so in answering this question of what went wrong in Anna's life, she said, "After 8 centuries, we cannot tell, and we cannot gauge the depth of feeling beneath her hysterical bombast," end quote. So she's bombastic and hysterical and all this. And other readers since then have said they just doubt whether or not, you know, she's really as upset as she says she is. In a revised translation published just a few years ago, Peter Frankopan said that her grief over her betrothed, Constantine, guy who died when she was young, needs a note. And she said, but in his note, like, he wants to put a note about why she's saying she's so sad, but he can't come up with any explanation. So he just says, "Her anguish is confusing since she did marry someone else. Constantine had also been implicated in a plot against Alexius, which makes her comments about him here all the more difficult to interpret," right? So he thinks this is really puzzling, but just hasn't a thing to say about it. But one strand of thought that has seized on political dissension, some hints we have of dissension at the change between Alexius to John in 1118, and woven these hints together into a story of Anna's failed coup, right, in which Anna masterminded an effort to seize power in the name of her husband, Nikephoros Vryennios, and that failed, and she suffered confinement in a monastery for the rest of her life. Right? And while I think we can safely assume that Anna wanted to be empress, and I think, you know, just about everybody would like to be empress, that's certainly safe, the sources for this political detention don't put their emphasis on Anna, and it's very hard to find this story of this coup unless you first presuppose that she was wildly politically ambitious, right? So if you start with the assumption that something tremendously horrible happened to her, and that she was extremely ambitious. And you start with this emotional backstory, then you can kind of make the stuff fit in together, right? But if you don't presuppose that, it's really a forced reading of the evidence, right? So then it's the need to explain her distressed state of mind in the Alexiad that provides the chief impetus behind seeing her as politically embittered. So it's the sense that she must have been politically disappointed has then led to unnecessary political readings of her text. So if you think she masterminded a coup and is imprisoned, right, then you can read all of her sadness in her text and say, oh yeah, yeah, she's really sad about her political disappointments, right? And so it strongly reinforces itself. So the story of Anna nursing a grudge for decades is what lies behind Constantine Favafi's famous poem about her, right? In the prologue to her Alexiad, this was written in 1918 by a, you know, Favafi, right? Great Greek poet from Alexandria, working from around 1900 to probably about 1925, 1930. Gorgeous. It's worth learning modern Greek to read Favafi, right? Gorgeous, gorgeous poetry, okay? But in the prologue to her Alexiad, Anna Komnene laments her woodyhood. Her soul is all vertigo, and I bathe my eyes, she tells us, in rivers of tears, alas for the waves of her life, alas for the revolutions. Sorrow burns her to the bones and the marrow and the splitting of her soul. But the truth seems to be that this power-hungry woman knew only one sorrow that really mattered, even if she doesn't admit it. This arrogant Greek woman had only one consuming pain, that with all of her dexterity, she never managed to gain the throne, virtually snatched out of her hands by the impotent John, right? This is actually a very standard reading of her life. And if you can see what it does, he acknowledges the grief that's in the prologue, which we'll be reading together in a few minutes, right? But he assumes that she's lying, right? It's not about her dead husband. It's not that she's sorrowful about being alone in the world, right? It's that she's really angry that she didn't get to rule, right? Because she's a philarch. She loves power, and she's ambitious, and she's arrogant, right? So it's a commentary on the emotion that assumes that the expressed emotion is false, but somehow yet reflective of her real emotional depth, right? And it impugns a lot of arrogance and ambition to her. The big shift in the way that I read Anna Komnene is that I'm trying to figure out what she was trying to achieve through her tragic self-presentation, right? What responses was she trying to get in her audience, right? So the scholars who are looking to explain Anna's emotions are accepting the expressions in the text as honest and transparent expressions of emotion, right, to her real emotional life, right? Sure, they think she's lying, but they accept that she sounds upset in the Alexiad because she was really upset about something, right? Yet, in other medieval Greek texts, we have really good reason to think that just because an author says he's happy or says he's sad or says he's really lonely or missing you, doesn't mean that he was, right? It means that the author wants you to think that because the author wants you to feel something, right? So it's this attention to the effective response of the audience is... It's a trend in Byzantine literature that's really helping us understand a lot of texts in new ways. And so what I'm doing is turning our attention to the intended effective response that Anna's trying to get. What was she trying to do by crying in her prologue? Right. And to start to answer that question, what was she trying to do by presenting herself this way? I start by sort of an assumption that she knew she was a girl, right? And she knew she was the first girl to try to write a Greek history, and she knew that Greek history was written by men, and that therefore she was trying to do something a little bit unusual, right? And perhaps difficult. So my first question then is, what is it about Greek history that makes it something open to men? Why do men write Greek history? Why do women not write Greek history? I mean, you haven't really gotten at those questions, but rather just said, oh yeah, women didn't do that back then, okay? I think if we can understand what the cultural impediments to Greek female history writing were, we can then understand what she was faced with as an author and try to understand what she was trying to do. How is she responding to those challenges, right? And I see that the problems she faced, I think, have to do on the one hand with a genre of Greek historiography, and on the other with 12th century conceptions of gender. Right? And those two lay out the big problems. So for Greek historiography, I want to bring up just a couple of characteristics of this genre, some of which you know, some of which you might not, that I think made it particularly difficult for women to write. First of all, the topic, history is about what men do and say in public, right? What they do in war and what they say in the assembly before they go to war. That's the topic. There's no social history. There's no cultural history. They would not have understood those concepts. It's stuff guys do in the public sphere. Men constructed their authority to talk about each other in the public sphere through their experience. History is written by old generals, right? Generals, people who are in the battles, people who had experience doing them, or experience in politics, experience in the assembly making speeches, they were the ones who were authorized to write history. History was also authorized through great elite education. So those few people who didn't have direct military political experience had very big education, right? And used that to show that they had read thoroughly all the other histories. They knew all of classical literature. They knew mathematics and all these other things. And that was their justification for writing. But that experience in affairs is the thing which it's very hard for a historian to be considered authoritative if he hasn't actually been in battle, right? Another characteristic is that it's supposed to be dispassionate. All right, dispassionate. So. You have to be impartial, right? You can't be caught up emotionally in the story you're telling if you're going to tell it straight, right? You've got to be able to, you know, sit back and be completely dispassionate and even-handed and not take sides and be fair, okay? And then you also, another characteristic of this, so it's written by people who are passionless. As a consequence, that one's all those I think are pretty easy to see, right? The self-aggrandizing nature of history is something that's a little harder for us to perceive, but it was very easy for the Greeks to perceive. And that is, if you're going to say that you're the person who gets to decide how a battle played out, whether a speech was effective or ineffective, you are judging men's deeds, right? You are evaluating, judging, discerning value, deciding what to put in the history, what to leave out of the history. Right? You get to decide what the great deeds. History is great deeds and great things said. Right? So you're the arbiter of greatness among men. So that's an extremely self-aggrandizing position. Right? Think, who are you to say what happened? Who are you to decide what happened, decide what had value, and then be the person to tell everybody else, this is what happened and this is what is of value. Right? So that puts a lot of both authority and aggrandizement into the teller of history. And the Greeks really didn't like arrogant people and had a huge number, numerous discourses for self-abasement and dealing with that self-aggrandizement. Right? So that's a big problem. It's a characteristic of Greek history writing. Now, when we think about these characteristics in terms of how they formed impediments to women, right, all of a sudden we could see a little bit of why women didn't do this much, right? That much. First of all, women don't go out into the public sphere, right? Greek women, remember when Thucydides wrote the Pericles funeral oration, he said about the Athenian women, the glory of the Athenian women is that nobody talks about you at all, right? That you've never done anything. He said it's the most wonderful thing about a good Athenian wife is that no one's going to say a word about her, right? Because she's always inside. In the domestic sphere, children, house, domestic economy, right? Not in public. Not speaking in public, not doing deeds in public, only going outside for funerals, right? Medieval, people who study the medieval Roman Empire try to talk about how much they're really always in the side, are they really always veiled, are they really, yeah, but normatively, right, you're supposed to be in the domestic sphere. Okay. Maybe you've gone outside, certainly not everybody was in a separate woman's room all the time. But the notional cultural division of spheres of life was that men were in the public sphere and women were in the domestic sphere. Right? So you can't really know anything. How would women know anything about the public sphere? Right? And then since you're authorized through experience, if you're never in the public sphere, you have no experience in the public sphere, what would you write about? Right? If you're in the women's quarters your whole life, how would you know what had happened? And then with education, Byzantine women had very basic education. They could read the Psalms, right? Basic literacy. Some of them, certainly we know, had enough education to also appreciate classical drama, classical tragedy and comedy, and read things, certainly enough to understand Homer. But they weren't supposed to be participating in those educational traditions. Normatively, the culture wanted women to be able to read the Bible, okay, even though we didn't. Right. Then, even more interesting, on this requirement that historians be dispassionate runs into problems with the Greek conception of passion and dispassion as gendered concepts. Right? The most basic root meaning of pathos, right, is passivity. Right? And that is considered part of female nature. Part of what makes women women is that they are passive and that they are subject to passion. So emotions rule women, and the nature of being subject to passion is an essential aspect of femaleness, right? Such that when men experience pathos, they are feminized, right? A person, a man who is not only can, it's all right, a man can be fully masculine and describe pathos, right? You can describe someone else's emotions in a very empathetic way, right? You can be empathetic. Right, but to actually be subject to it, right? And there, this gets complicated. But the basic point, just that for what this purposes of understanding this, right? Men are rule their passions, right? And that's an aspect of their masculinity. Right? And so, if a man is overly emotional, he is feminized. For a woman to gain control of her emotions, she has to transcend her female nature. Now, it's not unheard of for women to transcend their female nature because female saints did it all the time. How can you have a nun who actually can control the natural human passion for sex and for food, right? Well, she becomes masculine, right? So when a woman is able to control all those natural passions, she transcends her female nature, she becomes male. So basically all Byzantine women saints are honorary men. All right, so there's a precedence for this. Hi, please come in. but it means that fundamentally, right, to be a historian, one would have to transcend female nature, right? It's a requirement. Then, for the self-aggrandizement, this is, as I said, it's a huge problem for the male historians, right? Because history is essentially self-aggrandizing, they have to find ways to be strong historians but not be too obnoxious, right? A standard Byzantine way of doing this is to open up every history saying, I'm so sorry, my writing is so bad. I'm so sorry, I have a horrible stylist. I'm really sorry. I'm just going to write in a plain, simple style. And they say this whether their style is plain or simple or their style is completely convoluted and impossible to read, right? There's a 15th century, you know, marginal commentator who wrote on Nikitas Koniatis' history. Yet you say you're going to write in a plain, simple style because you don't know how to write Greek, but the rest of this is completely oracular, right? You know, so it's hard. So you claim that you're going to be simple-minded because you can't write. So that's simple. There's a discourse of humility that has a lot of different facets, all of which has to do with sort of performing humility in a very overt way. The other thing that it's very standard to do is saying that you have to record these events, right? I'm not so obnoxious that I want to be a historian, but somebody has to tell the history of this, otherwise it will get forgotten. And it will be forgotten through this stream of forgetfulness, and this time is pictured as this waving stream and this river that rushes everything off into oblivion and forgetfulness, right? So it has to be recorded. Another thing that they all do is say, well, I know someone's tried to tell this history before, but they've all been really bad historians, right? They've been biased, they've been corrupt, right? They've been passionate, they've been bad, right? It's kind of like sometimes a dissertation will say, like, all the reasons why the subject's, pointing out the flaws in everybody else's work so that there's still something to be said, right? Mm-hmm. That happens a lot, and it can be strange when you read along, why do Byzantine historians always open up by trashing everybody who's written the topic before? Well, it's because they're trying to be less obnoxious in themselves by creating a need for the history to be done, right? And then other particular qualifications. That's, I was there, or, I knew the guy who did it, or I was particularly close for this or that reason, right? I was a military attaché at that point. So those are the things that the men will do in order to explain why they're trying to write history without being so self-aggrandizing. Now, think about it. For Anna, it's a more complicated problem, right? First off, you know, Greek women are supposed to be inside. They're supposed to be in the domestic sphere. They're not supposed to talk, right? They're supposed to be modest. So the self-aggrandizing nature of history hits right at the point where they're supposed to be the most modest, right? So it's a much bigger problem, right? If you've been a judge in Constantinople and you've been on campaign and you've got to turn to right in battle, you're going to do all these things I just pointed out, right? Even though you're the guy who's experienced and you've been there and you know the guys, and it's fine for you to like put yourself out there because you're a general and you're a judge. She's not supposed to be talking in public, right? So for her, the self-aggrandizement modesty thing is just much more complex. The other problem that she has is that the things that she does to deal with the first three problems, right, necessarily make the self-aggrandizement worse, right? So, in order to present herself as an authority, right, who has the experiences and the education necessary to write history, she has to speak forcefully about her own great learning. She has to create a strong sense that she knows how to write. She also has to construct her subject as something that she knows about. So she constructs the subject of her history as always her father, right? And then it's possible for her to say something because this palace is the place where the public sphere and the private sphere overlap. Right? And so she's not talking about sort of random politics, she's talking about her dad. Right? So she constructs her father as her subject. That's her main strategy for getting around how she's able to either know anything or reasonably speak about the public sphere. But this has her constantly reminding the audience that she is the daughter of the emperor. And when she talks about her family, she's talking about herself. Right? And one of the most obnoxious things you can do in Greek culture is to talk about yourself. You just don't talk about yourself because it's considered obnoxious to make other people listen to you talk about yourself, and talking about your family kind of counted. Right? So this ancient Greek sense that it was obnoxious to talk about yourself and your family has now been shown very recently to be alive and cooking in the 11th and 12th centuries, right, when they're doing a lot of reading of classical Greek culture. This is a period when people are, not only do you have regular cultural continuity, they're also reading and contemplating classical Greek culture constantly. So this is a renewed idea, but it's much more, there are commentaries on Homer in which they're trying to explain at huge length why Homeric heroes will talk about themselves, because that's just so obnoxious. So it's in such bad taste, right? So they're trying to both valorize that text and explain away the boastfulness of the ancient people. Right, and also, I mean, I've had lots of undergrads, even now, who read this text, like, I don't really like her because she's always talking about how she's in the palace, right? And she's always saying, yeah, my dad, the emperor, like, she's always talking about how she's a princess, right? And it's just, it comes across as just a little bit, yucky, right? So, in that she starts talking about herself and her family, she appears more arrogant than is usual for a historian, right? And as Anna's story became a story about herself, it became distasteful. Right? But she had to talk about her father, because otherwise there'd be no reason to think that she would know anything or would have anything to say. So in short, Anna faced some pretty serious obstacles in writing history. That's why women didn't write history, right, in the ancient medieval world. Right? So, and I'm coming to see that a lot of the things that make the Alexiad so unusual are stemming from her vigorous efforts to maintain a female authorial persona in the midst of her participation in this male discourse. If she did not adapt her female self to the masculinity of the Greek historical discourse, she could not have written a history book. If she did not maintain her female voice in the midst of this historical writing, she would have been a natural freak. So central to my understanding of her history is the realization that she did not wish to appear to be transgressive. Although her decision to write history must be understood as fundamentally transgressive of the gender norms of her society. So she's breaking a lot of rules, right? But while modern people like people in the past who broke the mold, you know, she did it her own way, right? I think her goal was to find a way to be both a good woman according to the norms for her society and a good writer of history, right? To be simultaneously appropriate in her female behavior and a writer of an authoritative history. So her participation in this tradition of historiography necessitated very deep tensions between authorizing discourses, which insisted on her authorial skills, her rhetorical training, her knowledge, her expertise, and her ability to judge matters of the public sphere, and humbling discourses, which insisted strongly on her feminine modesty and humility. These discourses appear in competition and conjunction throughout her text. The places where she feels the need to insist on her access to legitimate historical information and dispassionate impartiality are also the places where she participates in rhetorical traditions for female behavior and deploys humbling, self-abasing discourses. Right? So it's when she wants to be the most masculine that she turns around and is the most feminine, and she does them in close proximity. And these passages are then very difficult. They can be really confusing. More so because what we don't see the masculinizing discourse as masculine, because that's just plain history, right? So when we're reading along her history and it seems like a normal history, which is most of the time, that's when she's participated in the masculine discourse, right? And so since we don't recognize that as masculine discourse, then we see this feminine discourse, we don't see it as motivated by anything, it just kind of looks sort of unhinged, right? But we retain, I think, enough of the basic idea of the importance of dispassion in history that it seems not only, she seems unhinged and kind of wrong, or at least odd, right? So a lot of the things I've been talking about, I think you can see in Anna's prologue. And the prologue is where the author has to gain the trust of his audience, right? So that's where the author puts out all of his qualifications and explains the reasons why he should be trusted and the reasons he should be seen as a good guy. And and also the prologue is where you show that you know the rules of the genre. Right? It's where you follow the conventions the most closely, because it's your prologue that you signal that you're writing a history and you're looking back to Procopius and to Polybius and to Thucydides, and these are your models. And they're this very standardized tropes of things that you say and things that you talk about in your prologue, and even a set order. And you're supposed to riff on them in your own way and sort of make them your own. You can't sort of like copy quote straight from somebody else. But you do your own version of a standard tune, right? And that shows that you know how to do the tune and you know how to write, okay? So I'd like to go through quickly. Hand up. Time for the handouts. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but this is let me see. Just illustrate a few of these key points. Okay. So her opening is very conventional. This, you know, time the ever-flowing stream bears all who breathe away. The time is the stream carrying things away off into forgetfulness. It's very conventional, but it's her own play on it. It shows that she knows the genre, and it starts off one of these big themes. Remember, why do you have to write history? Well, there's a strong compulsion. It's all these great deeds are going to be forgotten unless I show, then demonstrate them and write them down for the future. Right? So it's very standard. But you see actually in your handout, there's no point in having to relook at the screen. In the first paragraph, she brings up this reference to the tragedian, right? Bringing forth the hidden and then burying the visible. Sophocles, of course, right? It's not just a flourish for her, right? A lot of time these texts have been read, people just assume, oh, she's just showing off her education. People in her era talk to each other all the time through references, right? So you make the reference, you know your audience is going to catch the reference, and you use that to add an extra layer of meaning, right? And what she does here is quite interesting, because her point, right, is that time bears things all away, and it brings things to light, and then it buries them from light again, right? But Sophocles' point is different, right? Because she's quoting Ajax. And what Ajax is talking about is it's not the passing of time and forgetfulness at all, but rather the strangeness of human events. Ajax comes out of his tent and says, "All things long and countless years first draw forth from darkness, then bury from light, and there is nothing which man should not expect. The dread power of oath is conquered, as is unyielding will." So Ajax's point is sooner or later everything's bound to happen, and you should expect prodigious things. So Anna is also signaling here that you should expect prodigious things. But of course, anyone in her audience who could catch the illusion and remember that Ajax is talking about prodigious things will of course remember Ajax's next line. And so this is Ajax. His next line, what he goes on to say next, is that he turns into a girl, right? "For even I, who used to be so tremendously strong, yes, like tempered iron, I have been made female by this woman's words, and I feel the pity of leaving her a widow and the boy an orphan among the dames." Okay. He's lying, okay? It's a famous speech, right? If they were classicists here, I was going to tease about whether or not they could actually catch the second line, but I'm really very confident that they all could, because this isn't just any random part of Ajax. It's the most famous speech, in which he's in the middle of a pissing match, and he's not going to make up with somebody, right? Everyone's begging him to just say you're sorry, just get along with everybody else. And he says, no, I swear I never will. And then he comes out and says, yeah, I changed my mind, right? And he says, yeah, anything can happen. I've been made female by your words, he says to his girlfriend, who's been begging him not to leave her alone. And then he lies and says he's going to go and make up with the other guys, but then he kills himself instead, okay? So it's a really memorable speech, right? No one would miss it. And what they would get then is not only expect prodigious things, but if a man like Ajax can be made female, right, well, then what's the possibility for Anna? Right? She's just opening that up. She's not going to talk about that. But if he can be made female, perhaps she can be masculine enough, right? And then her illusion to Ajax's statement that he has become female is immediately followed by her most masculinizing sentence in the entire book, this big, thick book, mm-hmm. right? 1.2, which you can read, in which she states her name, and then she lays claim to a level of elite education that would put the vast majority of her contemporary elite men to shame, right? "I, Anna, daughter of the emperors Alexis and Irene, born and raised in the Porphyra," that's the purple room in the palace, right, where the emperor's children were born, "not without some share of learning, having studied Greek language in full, and rhetoric, and read through all the Aristotelian treatises and Platonic dialogues, having crowned my mind with Pythagorean terms of mathematics, I wish an account of this to tell and write in the deeds of my father." This is a masculinizing sentence for two main reasons. First, she's claiming a huge level of education in a culture in which women were supposed to read the Psalms. Second, that statement of her name, her place, and what she's going to write puts her in the tradition of, this is the history of Herodotus of Halicarnassus, right? Thucydides, an Athenian, wrote the history, right, of the Peloponnesian War, right? Within this tradition, the statement of the name of the author, where he's from, and what he's going to talk about is one of those very standard elements within the Greek history. They all have it. Every Greek history has a personal statement. I, the author, from, will tell you X. And they embroider it in all sorts of different ways. Right? So that in itself, to lay claim, I am part of this, back with Thucydides and Polybius and all the big boys, I, Anna, daughter of the emperors, born in the Porphyra in the palace, right? I have the education, and I'm gonna tell you the story. Right? Even in the midst of that, as I said, it's cheek to jowl, right? That authorizing claim right in the middle. Look here, I have it, the ellipsis, right? In your text, you can see, yeah, sorry, I have to tell you this. I'm not boasting. It's necessary to say these things, right? And it's not boasting. What zeal and God, right, and learning they've granted. I didn't get educated. It was zeal and opportunity and God that kind of did it to me, right? And then immediately start the next paragraph. 2.1, saying these things, I'm not coming to make some display of my rhetoric, right? Don't you think I'm just doing this to boast, right? And then moving forward at 2.2 and 2.3, she's talking about her relationship with her dad, right? How she's outlining how important it is for her to be writing about her father. That's, as I said, it's because making the subject her father is how she constructs a space where she knows what she's talking about, right? So she's telling us what her subject is that she can write about. It's her own father and his own deeds, right, which she did. So to some extent, she does this, she makes a reasonably credible scenario in which she could know what she's talking about, but it creates huge problems for her, and that the historical imperative to be impartial and even-handed and to mete out praise and blame when due conflicted strongly with one of her cultural's main female ideas, which is of being a virtuous female, which was honor your parents, right? So good daughters honor their parents. Right? They don't say anything in public, right? But what they do say in private is nice to their dad, right? So how are you going to be nice to your dad and a good, sweet little girl and honor your father if you're also going to mete out praise and blame in an even-handed fashion? So you see, at 2.2 and 2.3, she's trying to do both of these things. Right? She likes the moral character of history. She knows at 2.3, it's necessary to forget goodwill and hatred and frequently deck enemies with the greatest of praise when their deeds demand this, but frequently to expose what is most necessary when their failings of the pursuits indicate. Right? So you must not shrink to upbraid friends, nor to praise enemies. She's trying to say, I do both of these. Right? I want to do both of those. But she's worried at 2.2 because she knows that people are going to think that she's just lying when she praises her dad because she's being encomiastic, right? And if she doesn't lie to praise him and says that he's screwed up, then they're going to think that she's dishonored her father, right? That's the part about Ham and Noah, right, which is a story which indicated a child's lack of respect for the parent, right? There's a lot between the Bible and the 12th century. There's a lot of different things that happen to that story. But here, it's symbolizing lack of respect for parents, right? So she knows she's going to get it at both ends, right? And she has a very hard time reconciling those things, right? She lays out these issues, right? She knows she has to be impartial. That's a required part of the prologue, to this pledging fealty to impartiality. Right? She knows she also has to be a dutiful daughter, and those things are in conflict, and she says she's going to do impartial history anyway. Right? She then turns at 3.1 to talk about her husband, right, and his work. And she explains how awesome he was, that he was writing a history of her father when he died, right, when her husband died. And she explains that she is taking up this task from him and completing his work, which is another tool. So in trying to say why she had to write history, well, the deeds are so great. Time and forgetfulness are so awful. Also, she didn't want to write a history. She didn't take this up, but she's finishing her dead husband's work, right? She's just taking care of his papers. So it's a step which moves the impetus for history writing off of herself and on to something that's much more meritorious, right, and less self-aggrandizing, which is being the executor of her husband's work, right? So as a widow, she's just tidying things up. This is where, you know, Howard Johnson then goes, says, oh yeah, she says she's just tidying up his work. He wrote the whole thing, right? We have what he wrote, and hers is very different, right? It's really, really quite clear that, you know, she didn't write this chunk. But it's what the role and the function it has in the prologue is to take away from her the burden of saying that she herself wanted to write history. Right? Right, so there he is. Then she moves on to talk about the intense sadness she has when she remembers him. Right? At 4.1, right, basically. I become filled in my soul with vertigo and wet my eyes with streams of tears. Oh, what a counselor is lost to the Romans. It's better in Greek, all right? It's beautiful. This whole thing. His grace, his beauty, his knowledge in all things. Right? And then she turns, I, for my part, have been conversant with terrible things since my birth, except that I was born in the palace to emperors, right? That was good fortune. But everything else, the rest is waves, right? Full of turmoil. Right? Orpheus moves stones and wood and inanimate nature with his singing. Timotheus, the flutist, playing a martial tune, made Alexander jump to weapons of the sword. Right. I could force pathos from a stone, from inanimate nature, she says for herself. This is all a prelude. She's had all these terrible things happen to her life. Right? She mentions all these terrible things because the summit of this was the death of her Caesar, her husband, on the next page. The suffering of the Caesar and his unappointed death, unexpected. He's in his mid-40s. Okay. Reached to my soul and wrought the depth of pain. I hold all the misfortunes coming before this terrible misfortune as but a drop of rain falling into the whole Atlantic or onto the waves of the Adriatic. Right? So for all the misfortunes of her life to be but a drop, she has to play them up. So she's got these, all these horrible, horrible things have happened to me. And then my husband died. And then she has her grief. Oh, that fire that turns into ash without matter, fire illuminating the unspeakable, burning but not yet consuming, parching the heart, yet appearing that we are not also burned, even though we receive fire wounds until the division of the bones and the marrow from the soul. It's better in Greek. Okay. Here, she aligns her behavior here. This is not normal in history, all right? This is where this gets to be really strange. Like, she's writing, she has all the elements. You can do a checklist of everything that's in a classical Greek historical Greek prologue, and then it goes off the rails, and she starts talking about burning, you know, fire, funeral pyres of her husband and the marrow of her soul. But she aligns her behavior with the archetypal female object of pity and compassion, the mourning widow. The proper social response to a widow is to offer care and sympathy. Anna's presentation as an object of pity is a play to shift the affect of her historical work creates in her audience. So in lamenting her misery, Anna is trying to elicit pity from her audience, right? Presenting herself as utterly miserable, pitiable, bereft of her husband and her family, enabled her to appear more humble before her audience, right? So it's a humbling strategy. However, she tries to assert her impartiality, she knows that by simply talking about her family provokes accusations of self-praise and self-aggrandizement, right? And by simply doing history, she's provoking accusations of self-aggrandizement, right? She knows that problem. Her central strategy for dealing with that problem, as I see it, was the attempt to mitigate against the arrogance of what she was doing by getting her audience to see her as an object of pity. So the most important idea I have to offer is that her construction of her authorial persona as a miserable, mournful, isolated widow is intended to elicit feelings of pity in her audience. If the audience is feeling sorry for the poor, old, lonely widow, that sensation of condescending pity could lessen their resentment of the arrogant woman with the effrontery to judge men's deeds in the public sphere. Right? So in this, Anna was deploying what's known among the classicists as the stranger stratagem, which is first thought up by Glenn Most, in which talking about oneself in front of strangers was rendered less obnoxious by presenting one's story as a tale of woe. He went through all sorts of aspects of Greek literature. When people talk about themselves, remember they're not supposed to talk about themselves? They always say, oh, woe is me. I've got this horrible story. Let me tell you, the most horrible thing happened to me, right? And if it's the most horrible thing that happened to you, it's fine to talk about yourself because everyone's feeling sorry for you because you had this horrible thing happen to you, right? So it's sort of the tale of woe trope. And so all sorts of stories that are actually like not that bad, or even fine, all right, are cloaked in this framing of the tale of woe, and he figured out, right, well, that's because you're not supposed to talk about yourself, right? And then once, it's one of those things that nobody pointed out, but once you realize it, you see all over the culture that these just rules you're not supposed to talk about yourself unless it's a tale of woe. Right. So here, she knew that. She certainly knew all these other histories and these other things that use this. Right. So she is presenting herself. She's trying to get that emotional response of her audience that would see her as miserable and pitiable. At the end, that's not the final paragraph in her prologue. So she's completely crying. She doesn't end in tears because she says, I perceive my tears, I've been carried away. Right, the Caesar stood by me, and mourning for him instilled great mourning in me, right, for me. Now drying my tears from my eyes and recovering from my pathos, right, I have the double share of tears, but now I'm okay, and henceforth the narrative will be better and more clear and more historical. Historicotero. More history-ish, right? So she's showing that... she's signaling that she has pathos. She's a natural woman. She's a totally normal woman, right? But she can transcend her pathos. She can dry her eyes. She can take control of her emotions, put that behind her, and now she's going to be writing, take the high road of history. And every time she has one of these fits where she expresses pathos in the text, she closes it and says, now it's time to return to history. So she signals at either the beginning or the end of these that she's switching out of doing history and into doing a pathos-laden, lamenting, tragical speech. Tragic speech, right? And then she switches back to doing history, right? So she's saying she's trying to construct an authorial persona in which she's both fully female, fully subject to pathos, but able to control it, able to write it, authorizing herself, right? Don't forget, the end, she's got the suffering at the end of the prologue. Don't forget the self-aggrandizement and the authorizing discourses that come at the front, right? It's both together, right? So her authorial persona is as a humble, piteous, meritorious woman who is nonetheless able to transcend her female nature in order to participate in the masculine discourse of dispassionate historical writing. So, all right, pity the mourning widow is what she wants people to get out of this. But I think from the quotes I gave you at the beginning of this talk, it hardly needs to be said that that hasn't always worked. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that the actual emotional response of the audience has been that she is power hungry and that she's arrogant. And that's what fuels Cavafy. Yes, she says that her soul is parched with tears. Right. But the truth is this arrogant, power hungry woman had only one sorrow that really mattered. Her claims of misery have rarely elicited true pity. Many readers accept that Anna was really upset, but not about what she said she was upset about, but rather because of her loss of political power. Calling the idea of the failed coup of 1118 to explain her misery takes the vehemence of the emotion at face value, but takes her as lying about the cause of the emotion, and as expressing real emotion, right? Not saying that it's a literary thing that she's trying to get some emotion out of us. Part of the appeal of the coup story, I think, is that it allows Anna to be seen as having the personality of someone who desired political power, right? And she becomes Cavafy's power-hungry woman. The ease with which the political ambition and lust for power are attributed to her owes something, I think, to the lingering association between history writing and engagement in the public sphere. Without thinking it through, by any means, like no one's doing this consciously, but deeply held associations between history and politics have led scholars instinctively to feel that a woman writing history was necessarily politically ambitious. Lingering sensibilities regarding the self-aggrandizing nature of history writing account for the attribution of arrogance. A woman who thought so much of herself as to think she could write a history must have been arrogant. So basically, she gets hung for the arrogance and power lust because the same concepts of gender that she was fighting against, to some extent, are really still operative in the dominant readings of her text. Thanks for your attention.